The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're coming to you live from our Edstone studios here in the West Midlands, the beautiful Edstone campus, the sister campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College in Edmond, Oklahoma. Can't believe the work week is nearly over, a fast-moving week for sure. Coming up on today's program, we're going to be talking about the Book of Origins. That would be the book of Genesis. In particular, we're going to go through Genesis chapter 1. There was an interesting article, or I guess interesting maybe isn't the best word to describe it, but typical, written by a theologian. It was at Spectator, and it talked about some of the myths, as this preacher sees it, of the early part of the Bible. So we'll look into some of that and let you see for yourself what the Bible actually says. It's a shame that there's not more preachers who are out there actually pointing you to the scriptures. This article from Spectator is it's really thin on scriptural support, just lots and lots of human reasoning, sad to say. Also, quite a bit of news to get to here in just a moment. Friday means the weekend's nearly upon us, so we've got some new material, new content on the trumpet.com website. I'm not sure what my father's video will be yet. Hopefully that'll be posted sometime today. But he does have an article up there that's in the latest issue of the Trumpet magazine, God's College Proclaims the Gospel to the World. So you can get to that at the very top right corner of the trumpet.com website. And also, if you search around, you can see the new video for here in the UK, the Key of David program that we produce for the CBS stations here in Great Britain. And that subject is Sorrow Unto Repentance. We did play that audio earlier in the week, I think on Tuesday. But if you missed that, you can see the full video on the trumpet.com website as well. Well, it's not often that that we have a lot to say that agrees with Prince Harry here in the UK, but there's an article, this is from the BBC, which is quoting Prince Harry as saying that the video game Fortnite, that it should be banned. Can you believe it? He says that this is addictive and that it was created in order to get young people addicted to this game. And so according to BBC, his words, they're added to a growing debate. Evidently, there's a growing debate among health workers wondering about just how harmful this addiction is for our young people. He was speaking at an event in West London, Prince Harry was, earlier this week. And regarding this this video game, he says that it shouldn't be allowed. Where is the benefit of having it to your household? What good is it, in other words? What good is this video game? Look at what it's doing to our families. Well, that's me talking. He says it's created to addict, an addiction to keep you in front of a computer for as long as possible. He says it's so irresponsible. Good for him. Good for the prince. It's so irresponsible to just plop your children down in front of the computer screen and let them go for hours. And then you can't even peel them away from it for dinner or for any outdoor activity. He says it's like waiting for the damage to be done and kids turning up on your doorsteps and families being broken down. He went on to say that he said it's more addictive than drugs and alcohol. There's even a stat in this BBC article saying that research shows that for 200 of the divorces last year, this game, this video game, factored in. As far as the reasoning, well, we've got to split apart, Your Honor, because he won't leave Fortnite. Fortnite is more important to him than me. 200 divorces that you can at least blame partly on a video game. And so here is Prince Harry saying, we should ban it. We should get rid of it. It was created to addict young people. Now, when I read through this, I think about pornography. And how many, you think 200 marriages is a lot last year? How many marriages were ruined because of a video game? Well, how many marriages and families and young people have been ruined over the past couple of decades because of the prevalence of, the widespread prevalence of pornography? Look at how many people, even famous people, famous celebrities, sports stars, even politicians. Look at how many lives and families have been destroyed because of pornography. My father's written about this over the years. I saw one article from 2008, just looking at thetrumpet.com earlier, and he said that the reason it destroys politicians and leaders is because it's an addiction. It's like heroin, he said. He compares it to heroin. Pornography. So where are the calls for banning this? Well, we can't do that because you have to have freedom. You have to have the freedom of expression, the freedom of speech, they say. And yet look at how dangerous this is. I'm all for what Prince Harry says on the video. But what about this? What about this filth? You've heard the statistics before. America's biggest export, sex addiction, pornography, the widespread availability of it. The internet, of course, just making matters so much worse. My father, you should read the first, I believe it's the first chapter of No Freedom Without Law. An excellent chapter there about the pornography addiction. And my father makes the point there that there was a time when we declared war on pornography. Well, that didn't work out so well because we surrendered. We gave up. We admitted defeat. We lost the war. And so these things continue. They persist. These sicknesses, these addictions, these diseases. He said in that 2008 article, my father did, they don't grasp just how dangerous it is. The widespread use of porn is deadlier than an exploding nuclear bomb. So few voices who are out there saying, look, we need to stamp it out. People just accept it. Just even flipping through the channels the other night, it's just appalling some of the things that are on Freeview. The way that if it's not pornography itself, they talk about it as if it's just, well, it's normal. And you see these parents on these programs, in this one in particular that I just passed through, this mother talking to her daughter, both of them just talking about pornography, like it's the air they breathe. A teenage daughter. Not a discussion about what's evil about it and why you should stay away from it. A discussion about, what kind of pornography is your favorite? Unbelievable. Just right out there in the open. Fortnite's bad, but this is worse. This is even worse. And who will admit it? Who will talk about it? We have a lecture every day. We should. We have a lecture every year in Principles of Living on the subject. We go through the Ted Bundy case and all those tapes that he made before he died, and he's talking about how everybody in that prison system on death row, they were all, if they were in there for sex crimes, they were all addicted to pornography before they got into their sins, their worst sins, I should say. Rape and murder, that sort of thing. Well, at least there's a little bit of positive news coming from the royal family here in Britain. Prince Harry saying that, hey, let's get rid of this video game. It's hurting us. We should hear more messages like that. Yesterday on the program, I went through the 70th anniversary of NATO. Just a follow-up here from Real Clear Politics. It talks about the growth of NATO over the years. 29 nations now are in this alliance. But as this piece notes, the strength and the commitment of the member states in NATO, it's beginning to unravel. There's so much now in question. And then it refers to a few surveys, which are really shocking. Yesterday's show, if you go back to thetrumpet.com, you can listen to the podcast. But I asked on that program, is Germany really behaving like an ally of the United States? Are they? And then you look at these surveys. I didn't cover this yesterday, but listen to this. It says this poll found that a majority of Germans are indifferent to the security provided by the organization, or NATO. It says most striking is that 48% of German respondents think they should not provide military support to NATO member state if Russia attacks it. So they're part of the NATO alliance, Germany, and if Russia were to attack one of the member states, this is popular opinion in Germany. Well, we shouldn't really rise in defense of the NATO member. It says a majority are also against providing military support to the United States if it were attacked. So if the U.S. is attacked, let's just go through a theoretical attack here. If that were to happen, the Germans say, no way, don't defend the U.S. What do you mean, defend the U.S.? Of course we're not going to do that. Is this the behavior of an ally? It says the reason for Germans' indifference may be reflected by another finding. Germany no longer perceives Russia to be a great threat it once was. So they don't see Russia as a threat. Isn't that nice? They don't see the United States as an ally, and they don't see Russia as a threat. What's happening in the heart of Europe? What's happening in Germany? You listen to the press today, as I said yesterday, and it's as if the United States is the problem with the NATO alliance. But what about Germany? It says, finally, a majority of Germans even go so far as to say they perceive the U.S. to be a greater threat to their security than Russia. A majority of Germans, they see America as more of a threat than Vladimir Putin's Russia. Well, we're seeing more proof, more evidence of an upside-down world, that's for sure. Brexit, of course, is still in the news here in the UK. There was quite a lengthy debate again yesterday in Parliament, as you had some of these long-standing MPs who stood up to sound the alarm, this division between the electorate, the people, the citizens of Britain, Great Britain, and then Parliament. This clip that we'll play, this is from Lord Lawson. He's an older gentleman. He's been in Parliament for decades, and he was a very close ally of Prime Minister Thatcher way back in the day. And listen, hopefully you can understand it clear enough, but listen to what he said yesterday about Brexit and the ongoing struggles to just follow through on what the British people voted for. This is clip one.
I am deeply concerned at the growing rift between Parliament and the people, with the refusal to accept the people's judgment, whether you agree with it or not, very clear judgment on the referendum. I think that there is a real danger that undesirable but very often understandable insurrectionary forces will be feel that they cannot trust the British Parliament, they cannot trust the British Constitution, and a very ugly situation could well arise.
What he said there at the last was that a very ugly situation could well arise. And before that, you probably heard him talk about an understandable insurrectionary force or forces. People who feel like that they just can't trust the British Parliament. It's a real danger, he says. Now, as I've covered so often on this program, it's easy enough to spotlight the growing divide between the two sides in the United States. And you see where it's leading. Ezekiel 4 and 5 gives us a preview of that. And it's difficult to read. But in looking at this, this divide between the electorate and the elites, it's a pretty sharp chasm between the two. He said, this Lord Lawson, he said yesterday that he had served in Parliament for 45 years, and that there has, as he said, never been an instance of constitutional vandalism of the scale that we are witnessing today. Constitutional vandalism. It's as if the Constitution is just being shredded. Another member of Parliament, he too talked about the danger of revolutionary action. In fact, he referred to the action in the House of Commons as being revolutionary because it goes so hard against the will of the people. It's a dangerous precedent. Sharp division here in the UK, and of course, it's certainly on display every day in the United States as well, the radical left, as it just continues to get more and more radical, these candidates for 2020. I think there's 18 of them now. They're all out there trying to outdo each other. They're trying to take it a step lower in the direction of progressivism or radical Marxist leftism. Bernie Sanders was on a comedy show last night, and he made it was a pretty important point about just how different it is 4 years from when he was seen as more of an extremist. And today, his beliefs, today, what he's campaigning for, it's in the mainstream of the Democratic Party. It's not Bernie Sanders way off. We wrote a few articles, if you remember, back in 2015 and 16 about just how popular Bernie Sanders' message was given how radical it was. Today, it's right in the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Here's what he said on the comedy show, clip two.
4 years ago, Trevor, the ideas that we talked about, the idea that healthcare is a human right, not a privilege.
Right. Well,
4 years ago, that was perceived as a radical idea. Not anymore. The idea that if you work 40 hours a week in this country, you should make at least $15 an hour and not live in poverty. Not a radical idea anymore.
Radical ideas just a few years ago, but not so anymore, as the party just takes a sharper and sharper turn to the left. As I say, they're all out there trying to outdo each other. They're all out there. They're tripping over themselves, apologizing for previous positions that they had, in some cases just a few months ago. We put together this montage of the Democrats out there apologizing for previous stances that they had, in some cases just a few years ago, but that today they're not accepted. The Democratic base will not accept it. You have to toe the line. You have to conform, or you have no chance. This CNN report that we looked at, just trying to pull together some of these clips for the montage, it talked about how that when you get closer to the general election, you'll maybe see a few more apologies as people try to align these politicians try to align their thinking with the general public. But this early in the game, even CNN was saying, you don't often hear this many apologies 2 years out. Listen to some of the Democratic candidates. This is clip three.
I haven't always been right.
I was wrong to feel that way.
I apologize. It was a big mistake when it was made, but it's trapped an entire generation.
They certainly weren't empathetic, and they were not kind, and I did not think about suffering in other people's lives.
To the women in our campaign who were harassed or mistreated, I apologize.
I sincerely repeat my apology today. I'm deeply sorry for having said them.
I am so sorry that she had to go through what she went through.
I certainly apologize to any woman who felt that she was not treated appropriately.
My apology is an apology for not having been more sensitive about tribal citizenship and tribal sovereignty.
In my past, I said and believed things that were wrong. And worse, they were very hurtful to people in the LGBTQ community and to their loved ones. I'm deeply sorry for having said them.
I was callous to the suffering of families who want to be with their loved ones, people who want to be reunited with their families. And I recognize, as we all do, that immigration and diversity is our strength as a country. It's always driven our economy. It's the American story. Mm-hmm. And so looking back, I really regretted that I didn't look beyond my district.
Not only will I not say that again, but I'll be much more thoughtful going forward in the way that I talk about our marriage, and also the way in which I acknowledge the truth of the criticism that I have enjoyed white privilege.
That last one there from Beto O'Rourke, who's been out there apologizing for, I guess, his whiteness. You don't want to offend the LGBTQ community? If you had a stance previously against homosexual marriage, or if you were strong on border security, you've got to repent of that. You've got to say you're sorry if you're going to be able to compete. If you're going to have a chance of being the Democratic frontrunner, you've got to apologize, and a lot of them are doing it. They don't apologize for the Russian collusion hoax. None of them apologize for that, anything like that, where they actually got it wrong, where they actually caused a lot of damage, where they actually hurt people, where they actually were behind people going to jail, losing their life savings, losing their homes, their mortgage. They couldn't pay it because they had to pay for lawyers, and they want to continue with this charade. Congress does. The House of Representatives, the Democrats in the House, they want to continue with this as they bring all of these witnesses to come before the House for maybe a third or a fourth time now. And they've got to bring all of their lawyers, and they've got to defend themselves. No apologies for that, because that's about destroying Donald Trump. But if it has anything to do with traditional values, upholding traditional values, they must apologize. They must. They have to. Just a few months ago, I think it was at a rally when Beto O'Rourke talked about being opposed to slavery reparations. But then there's a story today saying that after pressure coming from Al Sharpton, he's flip-flopped. Well, now he's open. He's open to it, you see. He's apologized for being white. Now he's open for this. The New York Post says today, this week, nearly every single Democratic candidate for president, save the otherwise distracted Joe Biden, has or will appear at Sharpton's annual convention for his National Action Network, which he calls a charity. Sharpton calls it a charity. A more rational observer might call it a personal piggy bank funded by shakedowns. This is a man who, as the Post exclusively reported in December, sold the rights to his life story to his own nonprofit, paying himself $531,000 on top of the $244,000 salary that he gets from this nonprofit organization. So he's paying himself. He's selling the rights to his biography to himself, to his own nonprofit group. And then he's out there threatening these organizations or these individuals, saying that if you don't contribute, this is the gist of the New York Post article, if you don't contribute to my nonprofit, I might charge you with racism. He's a race baiter. He's a professional race baiter. And then you have all of these Democratic candidates cowering before him in fear. They do not want to offend him. They do not want for Sharpton to be on their bad side. Because, well, you look far enough into the past of Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or Beto O'Rourke, or Kamala Harris or Cory Booker. Surely you can find some kind of racial insensitivity. Surely you can find it if you go far back enough. It's unbelievable what has happened to the Democrats in the United States. The Post says on Friday, every candidate from Kamala Harris to Elizabeth Warren to Bernie Sanders will nonetheless kiss the ring of Sharpton, as Beto O'Rourke did on Wednesday afternoon. Beto pulled a cynical 180-degree turn on his former opposition to reparations. In other words, he was against it just last month before he was absolutely for it today. So much pandering. So much duplicity. So much corruption. So much abuse of power. And so many of these same politicians, they're out there accusing Donald Trump of what they themselves are guilty of. And it's all meant, just like the Mueller probe, it's all meant to be a satanic distraction to distract us away from the real evil. Here they are, just absolute egg all over their faces a week and a half ago. The Mueller report comes out, no collusion, no obstruction, just knocked to the canvas for the count. They've staggered back to their feet, and now they've come up with the narrative that, well, hang on a second, we're starting to get some sources. Sources are telling us that there's more to this report. There's some damaging information. It actually might end up hurting Donald Trump in the long run. That's why we need all the pages revealed, all 400 pages, and all the supporting evidence. It's got to be revealed to the general public. That's what they're saying now. Listen to how excited NBC's Ken Delanian is. The sources that he's in contact with from Mueller's team, they're leaking, mind you. Well, he's excited because these leaks suggest that there's more to the report than Attorney General Barr let on a week and a half ago. This is clip 5.
We are told that there are members of Mueller's team who are frustrated that William Barr stepped in and essentially cleared the president on obstruction when Robert Mueller didn't do that. And it was unclear his intent when he didn't do that. But what we're told is that at least some members of the Mueller team believe that the intent was to allow Congress and the public to make their own decision about the evidence. You know, Mueller didn't make a call, and he left the field clear for William Barr to come in there and pronounce that that there was no prosecutable case for obstruction. What we don't know is to what extent, if at all, Barr consulted with his friend Robert Mueller, they go back a long time, about this decision. We don't know how Robert Mueller feels, but we are told that members of Mueller's team are frustrated, and as the Post and the Times reported, and we are also reporting, are also frustrated with how Barr depicted the state of the evidence on obstruction. They say that there's actually some compelling evidence once we see the report. And in another aspect of this, guys, we're hearing from a separate U.S. official that some members of the Mueller team say that the evidence on collusion, while not establishing a criminal conspiracy, is actually very compelling. Some of it may be classified, but to the extent we get to see it, Mueller's report talks a lot about those contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia and raises the issue of whether the Trump campaign was manipulated by a sophisticated Russian intelligence operation. So
NBC, they're really excited. This could we're going to resurrect this. We have to. We have no choice. This was the only way we got ratings before. The ratings plummeted last week. Now they're getting back to their feet, and they're going right back to the Russian collusion. Can you believe this? The New York Times had a big reveal yesterday. People from Mueller's team, who evidently told associates that, well, we're not real happy with the way Barr went about this. He didn't reveal everything. Well, he never said that he was doing that. It was meant to be a summary of the central charges and whether or not they recommended charges or not. No collusion. No obstruction of justice. Well, the Times is writing about this. They, too, excitedly talking about how that this report, if we can just get it fully revealed, Maybe there's damage yet to be done on this presidency. The Times wrote yesterday, at stake in the dispute, the first evidence of tension between Mr. Barr and the special counsel's office is who shapes the public's initial understanding of one of the most consequential government investigations in American history. Just think about that statement for a moment. The Times is wondering, you've got, the way the Times sees it, you've got the left-wing prosecutors on Mueller's team, and then you've got Attorney General Barr, who was appointed by Mr. Trump. So he's obviously compromised. Again, this is just the narrative. This is like the default position, the way that a Times reporter would approach this story. And what's at stake here is which side is going to be able to shape the public's initial understanding of this investigation. It's not about getting to the truth. It's not about the facts based on the evidence that comes in. It's none of that. It's about shaping the narrative. Some members of Mr. Mueller's team are concerned that because Mr. Barr created the first narrative of the special counsel's findings, Americans' views will have hardened before the investigation's conclusions become public. Well, they got the first shot to shape the narrative. So we're concerned that we might really have our work cut out for us to create an alternate narrative. This is right out of the Ben Rhodes School of Journalism. The Ben Rhodes School of Shaping Public Opinion. Remember how he just mocked reporters in that New York Times piece from 2016? Oh, they're so ignorant. They're young. A lot of them, they're in their 20s. They're coming out of journalism school, and they don't know anything about the world. And it's so easy to fool them. This is what Ben Rhodes was saying. Shaping the narrative. Kim Strassel, writing at the Wall Street Journal, she says the only surprising thing about the new cover-up accusation against the Attorney General William Barr is that it took 2 weeks to get out there. The only thing she's surprised by is that the Democrats didn't come out with this earlier, this nonsense. That, well, actually now we think the Attorney General's covering things up. And she writes in her piece how that a lot of Republicans are probably going to cave to the pressure. We'll just give them what they want. Give them, there's some on the Republican side that say, just give them the whole report. And as she brings out in her piece, if they get the whole report, unredacted, all the supporting evidence, if they get all of that, they'll just cherry pick what they want and then leak it out. It'll be a death by a thousand cuts. That'll be their approach. That's been the approach for 2 years. Why should we expect it to change at this late in the game? Their focus, their intent, their purpose is to destroy this president, or at the very least, to keep these investigations going right up until the next election. She says if Republicans think that just giving them everything is going to finally get them to admit that, okay, well, we got it wrong on collusion, you're not watching what's happening. You're not based in reality. They will never admit they're wrong. The only thing they'll admit they're wrong about is if they had a leftist position 5 years ago that's now outdated. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. And don't forget, you can also send us an audio file or audio feedback at the trumpet.com, or rather the Trumpet Daily Radio Show page at the trumpet.com website. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
We're running the program live on YouTube today. We've had some technical difficulties with that in the past, so we're trying to iron those out. But if you're interested, not too many people know about it, but the live stream, the video of the live stream is available at our Trumpet YouTube channel. So if you wanted to switch over, I think that's running on a 10-15 second delay. So if you switched over right now, you probably wouldn't miss anything. And you could also see our beautiful set. The guys have been working with some of the trumpet covers in the background and a few books, even a basketball for all of all things. But it looks very nice and very cozy. That's at our YouTube channel. Well, Richard Holloway, he's an Episcopalian priest. He wrote an article recently for The Spectator here in the UK. And he's a theologian, I guess. But the way that he talks about the Bible, the way that he talks about God's Word, I guess for the UK, it's typical. He's reviewing this new book by John Barton. In this piece, A History of the Bible, the story of the world's most influential book. And he, like Barton, he views a lot of the Bible as essentially fake. It's fake, like the book of Daniel. It was written many centuries after Daniel pretended to have written it. In other words, it wasn't written by a guy named Daniel in and around 600 or so BC. It was written hundreds of years later by some guy, and he just kind of inserted Daniel into the narrative. He created a narrative. These are theologians that believe this. That's pretty amazing. And they're out there saying that what Christians need to do today is just accept. This is Holloway's quote. He says, to accept it as it is, in all of its mythic beauty. It's beautiful. I like it. It's a nice book. But you have to accept that it's myth. The Bible's full of myths. There's just stories, basically. Here's what Holloway says in the piece. So why can't we settle for a more... In other words, his point is, I should have set it up better, but his point is that if people are so inclined to just sort of shape the myths into what they want them to say, then why can't we do the same thing and settle for a more tolerant and ecumenical attitude to the stories we all tell ourselves and the ways we tell them? He says, after all, which of us really knows what's going on? That's a theologian. That's an Episcopal priest. And I assume he has congregants somewhere, I think up in Scotland. And he says, which of us really knows what's going on? Isn't that a comfort? Isn't that a faith builder? I speak tongue in cheek, of course. How ridiculous to look at the Bible as if it's just this collection of nice stories. Well, you look at even the Church of England. Years ago, this was after the tsunami in 2004, the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, Rowan Williams, He said after this tragedy of epic proportions, he said that this tsunami makes him doubt God's existence. And even the current Archbishop of Canterbury, he's made statements more recently about his doubts and that, well, at times I have doubts about God's existence. Well, going back to that statement from 2004 from Rowan Williams, my father had a program years later where he questioned that statement and asked if it agrees with Christ. Here's this tragedy that killed hundreds of thousands of people. And when we turn to the Bible, we should be able to get answers. But here are great theologians in Britain. They don't have answers. In fact, they see these tragedies happen and they question God. They question even his existence. Does that really agree with what the Bible says? Listen to what my father said in this Key of David program from 2011, clip 6.
Now, Jesus Christ said, these earthquakes are going to come. And famine, and that shortage of food and water, and pestilence, which is just disease epidemics that often come from wars and earthquakes and the like. Jesus Christ said they're coming, and there's going to be a lot of them just before his second coming. And in fact, it's a sign of his second coming. And it's a sign that it's an end of this age of man ruling over man. And the Archbishop asked, well, how can God allow suffering on such a massive scale? Well, how can he allow that? That's a pretty harsh evaluation of God. But how about, he never did evaluate, he doesn't have anything to say about man and what we're doing and whether or not we're worthy of God's protection or have the faith to even be protected from God, by God. I mean, really, God says these catastrophes are coming, and he mentions it in the context of a lot of evil. But the minister didn't say anything about that.
You look into the Bible, and that's right. You see all of these prophecies saying that these catastrophes are coming, and he mentions it, these prophecies, in the context of a whole lot of evil. So here come these theologians after the tragedies happen, and they say, boy, I can't see why God would do this. And it makes me question his existence. What a harsh evaluation of God, like my father said there. What about man? What about what we're doing? What about, like I talked about in the very first part of the first segment, the things that we allow, the filth that goes out, just streaming out of the United States and Britain. Nothing to say about that, certainly nothing strong. But then a tsunami happens, and it's God's fault. God's the problem. No wonder so many of these theologians and their followers can so easily become disillusioned. This Holloway piece, again, he's reviewing this book by John Barton. He used to work at at Oxford University. He mentioned in the article that Oxford University Press sells 250,000 Bibles every year. 250,000 Bibles every year. That's a lot of Bibles. That's just the Oxford University Press sending out all these King James versions, most of them, I assume. It's the world's number one bestseller. There's a lot of authors that would be quite happy to have 250,000 copies of their books purchased. 250,000 every year. Holloway writes in his piece, "Nevertheless, this scholarly caution has never stopped determined believers reading their own opinions into the Bible and forcing it to tell you to tell the story they want it to tell." And then listen to this example he uses. A good example of the absurdities to which this can lead is illustrated by how some of them handle the opening chapters of the book of Genesis that tell us that God created the world in 6 days. Does the opening chapter of the Bible tell us that God created the world in 6 days? Is that what the Bible says? Why doesn't he take you to the Bible? Why doesn't he quote chapter and verse? We'll go through that in just a second. He says there are conservative Christians who cleave to the belief in a six-day creation because they are convinced that the Bible can never be wrong about anything, thus placing themselves on an unnecessary collision course with modern science. We don't want to collide with modern science. We have to submit to science. We have to submit to modern science. If science says it, then we're wrong. If science says it, then we've got to believe it. If God says it, you have to question it. You have to question it. You have to be skeptical. You have to be mindful that these are a lot of fakes. A lot of these books are just fakes. They're myths. So say the theologians of Great Britain. A collision course with modern science, to the delight of evangelical atheists who quote them as proof of the infantilizing nature of all religious belief. So you have people of religion that hold to these non-biblical views, and then they're laughed and mocked at, or laughed at and mocked by the evangelical atheists. Let's look at what the opening verses of Genesis have to say. This is the book of origins. This is the beginning. Herbert Armstrong used to talk about the beginning of the movie, how that if we're going to understand the overall purpose for man, God's purpose for creating mankind in the first place, we have to go back to the start. And as you study Genesis, just the first chapter, this book of origins, you read about the original creation. Okay, we'll get to the timing in just a second. Then there's the angelic rebellion and the destruction that followed, the destruction that we see even to this day throughout the universe. And then you have the renewal of the original creation. That's what most of Genesis 1 is devoted to, the renewal. And then you have the special creation of man there toward the end of chapter 1 in Genesis. Genesis 1 and verse 1, it says, in a beginning, it should read, in a beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Notice what it does not say. It does not say that about 6,000 years ago, God created the heaven or the universe, heavens plural, and the earth. God did create it, but he doesn't say that it was 6,000 years ago. In fact, nowhere in Scripture does God ever tell us at what time he originally created the earth and the universe. But we certainly know that the earth and the universe had a beginning. They have a creator. The creator made the entire universe. In a beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. He created the earth and its surrounding heavens. So there was a beginning. Now, preachers today, as I just read, they just, I guess, hurriedly read through this first chapter and assume that this means that the earth, along with Adam, along with mankind, the creation of mankind, that if we take this literally, it means that everything was brought into existence just 6,000 years ago. And of course, that gives the evangelical atheists, that gives them a lot of firepower as they go after Christians. The introduction to our series, The Bible Story, it says, and I know many of you know this, but some of you listening for the first time or new to the truth, This may be a spectacular revelation for you, but it says in the Bible story, between the first and second verses of Genesis 1, tremendously important events occurred which are related in other parts of the Bible. Between these two verses, Genesis 1 and verse 1, and then Genesis 1 and verse 2, I read verse 1. Verse 2 says, "And the earth was without form and void." So God created the heavens and the earth. And then the earth was, or became, is the real meaning there, without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. So those are the first two verses. Now, like that Bible story brings out, you have to look to other related parts of the Bible to understand what happened here in the gaps. Notice Isaiah 45 and verse 18. This is the prophet Isaiah's work. And this is important. This is really important because you're going to see some of the same Hebrew words in Isaiah 45, as we'll note in Genesis 1 in just a second. It says in verse 18, "For thus says the Eternal that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it," it says, "and established it." So God, he made the heavens. That means the universe. He's the creator of the universe and the earth. He made it out of nothing. He brought it into existence. The spiritual realm brought matter, physical matter, into existence. You can look at Hebrews 11 and verse 3 on your own time, where it says that the things which are seen to back up, through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. It was all brought into existence by an invisible power, an invisible being. God used invisible spirit energy, to bring matter into existence. The plain truth from back in 1984, it says the real Big Bang was a well-planned, deliberately executed act of creation. How would you expect a super powerful divine being to bring forth an entire universe with a small fizzle, a limp, a thud, or a weak whimper? Of course not. The creation of the universe was accomplished with a glorious display of light, heat, matter, and energy, a display that still reverberates throughout space. Now, scientists who don't believe in God, they would say all that happened just, I guess, by fiat, just happened out of nothing. It exploded onto the scene. There was a big bang. God's the one who brought it into existence. God did it. And he didn't say, he doesn't reveal when it happened. It could have been millions of years ago. It could have been billions of years ago. The last part of verse 18 says, "He created it not in vain." The Hebrew word is tohu. "He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Eternal, and there is none else." God created it, this material creation. He didn't create it in vain. He didn't create it to be waste and empty. Nothing like that. He created it to be inhabited. It says it right there in Isaiah 45:18. Now, go back to Genesis 1. We'll have to hurry. We're about out of time. And as you turn there, let me just give you a quote from IHP. It says, "What God creates, he maintains. What he creates for a purpose." You see that in Isaiah 45:18. "He intends it to be put to use, a right use that preserves and improves." So coming back to Genesis 1, it says, "In a beginning, God created the heavens," plural, "and the earth." And then verse 2, again, keep in mind the gap. Verse 2 says, "And the earth became without form." That's the same Hebrew word, tohu. It became wasted and empty. Chaos, decay. That's the meaning of that Hebrew word. It became. The earth became without form and void. So something happened. God didn't create it to be this way. We know that from Isaiah 45. But how did it become that way? as it says there in Genesis 1 and verse 2. Well, that's where you need to study into the creation of God's spiritual realm, or the angelic host. They were brought into existence even before the material universe. They shouted for joy, the angels, when the earth and the surrounding heavens were brought into existence. But Lucifer led a great rebellion against God, and that led to a lot of chaos and destruction and waste and decay all across the universe. And so what happens from verse 3 on to the end of chapter 1 in Genesis is God is actually recreating the surface of the earth. Read the fall. We don't have time to go through it. We'll have to, I guess, save it for next week. But read the following verses now that you know this backstory. Read verse 3. Read verse 4. Read verse 5. And see what your Bible has to say. Well, as I say, we'll have to come to that at a later time because we're out of time. On today's program, you're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit an email, don't forget you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. Also, you can send us voicemail at the Trumpet Daily Radio Show page at the trumpet.com website. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you on Monday.